So, today's lecture will be a little bit short. So I was laid out with the flu over the weekend and didn't get to prepare as much material as I would have liked. Most of the lecture will focus on kind of expanding upon what we discussed last week regarding the orthodox interpretation and the measurement problem that arises in that interpretation. At the end of the lecture today, which will probably end only after an hour or so, Ray and I will go through, first of all, a web page you can access for course information, and secondly, what the terms will be for the term project, so what kinds of projects we have in mind and what will be expected. Okay, so last week we discussed, what does it mean to interpret a theory? And, this is kind of a trivial exercise for theories, classical theories, but in the case of quantum theories, it becomes non-trivial. So we talked about the difference between operational and ontological bridge principles. So operational bridge principles are rules that relate elements of the mathematical formalism to measurements being performed kind of in the lab, so to speak. So they're an adequate set of rules that allow us to use the theory to explain outcomes, prepare states, but they don't necessarily give us insight into the what's really going on question, into what the underlying physical properties are of a system, and what the underlying physical reality is here. So a very important example of an operational bridge principle in the case of quantum theory is the Born rule, which relates the relative frequency of outcomes observed given the same measurement repeated on an ensemble of identically compared systems. And that is that the probability of outcome k, given the preparation rho, given by the trace of rho and the projector onto the eigenstate by k. Now, in the case of, there's this kind of a second tier to interpretation. It's not just coming up with rules to allow you to use the theory, but coming up with a set of rules or principles that allow you to associate elements of the mathematical formalism with elements of physical reality. So we call these correspondence rules, calling them bridge principles in the spirit of Bridgman's approach. So here, in some loose sense, we described the Copenhagen interpretation last class, and like I said, even though it was very kind of agnostic about what could be said about physical properties, it is in some sense an ontological interpretation, not just an operational one. And that's because it goes so far as to say that an independent reality in ordinary physical sense can neither be ascribed to the phenomena nor to the agencies of observation. So its kind of ontological statements are largely denying what we can say about the ontology, about the system's properties. And Bohr also insists explicitly that deducing additional information about the properties the system possesses is impossible in principle. So here he says at one point that the more complete analysis Einstein seeks, Einstein is an advocate, in fact, quantum states are incomplete, he says, is in principle excluded. So here he's going further than just laying out rules by which we use the theory, but actually stipulating how the theory can be understood ontologically. Or in fact, how it can't be understood ontologically. Yes?
Because you can't make a measure in between, we have no reason. We can't see the out of what's happening between.
I don't think it would reduce to the simple statement that simply because the only way we get information about systems is by doing measurements on them. And I think it's the deeper problems of quantum mechanics, like the fact that quantum states always predict a non-vanishing dispersion for non-commuting operators. So if I prepare a state which gives a definite outcome for some operator, then it predicts a distribution of outcomes for another operator. So that non-commutativity aspect and the fact that quantum states don't allow assigning determinate values to all outcomes is kind of a deeper property beyond that more elementary fact that we only learn things through observation. So let's review some of the points we made about the orthodox Dirac von Neumann interpretation. So as stated, I gave you several quotes last time, and as stated more or less explicitly by both Dirac and von Neumann, an observable can be said to have a determinate value if and only if the state is an eigenstate of that observable. So this is clearly an ontological principle. It's telling us what properties the system has independent of observation. So if the system can be described by such a state, then it has such a property. This has been called by Arthur Fine the eigenvalue eigenstate length. And notice that it actually implies that the quantum state provides a complete description of a system's objective physical properties. So it's telling us the necessary and sufficient conditions by which we can describe a property. And that depends only on the quantum state. So in this sense, the quantum state is a complete description of a system's physical properties. So as I just mentioned in response to that question, we have this property of quantum mechanics, which is that we have a finite dispersion, a non-zero dispersion for some complementary variables. So there will always be operators for which we can't predict with certainty the outcome. And if we repeat the same preparation and make several measurements, and make measurements on different representations of that, different systems prepared by that procedure, then we get a distribution of outcomes. So the completeness assumption, or the eigenvalue eigenstate length, which implies completeness, also implies that the unavoidable non-vanishing dispersion of outcomes, this is Robertson's uncertainty principle, is due to a fundamental randomness or stochasticity in nature. In other words, if we have the complete information and that's not enough to specify the outcome we get, then there's a fundamental randomness at play, which is unavoidable. So that's modifying the kind of classical conception of this deterministic, objective world that's evolving according to Hamilton's equations. Here we have all of a sudden introduced this new element of randomness. And I should say here that von Neumann was not naive. He was well aware of the fact that there was another explanation for the non-vanishing dispersion, and that was the existence of some hidden coordinates, which are not specified by the quantum state. And if supplied, we'd be able to fully determine the outcomes of non-commutative variables. But he rejected this possibility because of an impossibility proof that he devised against dispersion-free assignments for all observables. So state assignments, where here the state assignments aren't quantum states, but just a more abstract assignment of outcomes for all observables. I'm hoping on Thursday we'll get to go through von Neumann's argument. This argument was later discredited by Bohm, who constructed an explicit invariable model, and also by Bell, who showed explicitly that one of von Neumann's assumptions was unreasonable, and only really disqualified a very trivial class of invariable theories, not all invariable theories. So that's just an advertisement for something we'll come to on Thursday, but just to note that that issue was in von Neumann's mind for a very long time, from the very beginning. So the second key property of the orthodox interpretation is the projection postulate. So this is that after an ideal measurement of an observable, the system state is transformed into, or updated to, the eigenstate associated with the eigenvalue observed. I added the parenthetical quote because I didn't want to bias the physical meaning of this postulate. This is what's been also known as the classical wave function. And I want to mention and emphasize that it's operationally demanded for consistency with experiments involving sequential ideal measurements. So the point is that the projection postulate isn't something that's controversial. What we're going to see, what's controversial, is when you combine this direct projection postulate with the completeness assumption. And that is, like I say next, the eigenvalue eigenstate length implies that the projection has to be a physical process. because now when you update the state, you're updating something that represents the physical properties of the system. So this is a physical transformation taking place. And so that's when all of a sudden collapse takes on this more controversial character. And notice that if we reject the eigenvalue eigenstate thing, and hence reject that the quantum state is a complete description of the system's physical properties, then the projection after measurement does not correspond to the physical process. In this case, it can be conceived of as just an update rule of an abstract quantity representing our information about the system. So I mentioned the example of Newton mechanics last week, wherein one assigns a probability density to a system. It has a definite property. One doesn't know the exact property the system has. So you assign a probability distribution. When you gain information, partial information about the system's say position, then you truncate the probability density to be consistent with the new information you obtain. So what's being transformed isn't some physical property, but this abstract tool that you're using to describe the system, namely the probability density. Yes?
For the projection postulate, in a quantum mechanics course last term, we looked at it as whether it's needed as an extra postulate or whether it's all there. It was in the case of two particles, one's the one you're looking at. If you looked at it just in terms of that particle, you need a projection postulate. So then we had an environment particle, and you went to the bigger system. I thought what we found, I'd have to look at the exact argument to make it more clear, but we found that you didn't actually need a projection, it was continuous evolution. Are you talking about the same sort of thing, or is there a nuance to it? Are you talking absolutely false?
Okay, well, actually, on the next page, I'm going to distinguish two forms of projection posture. And maybe you can bring that question up again and tell me which of those it was that it was described by a unitary operational control system. Let me just add that because of the fact that I have not prepared enough material for the full time allotted for a lecture, then today in particular, the discussion is more than welcome. especially if it involves clarification from some of the other experts in the room. So with the projection postulate, it's useful to distinguish whether or not one is also imposing the idea of post-selection. So let's take, for example, we have this ideal measurement of some non-degenerate observable R, which is eigenvalues lambda sub k, they're basically labels, and eigenstates phi sub k. Now, if we ignore the outcome of the measurement, so we perform the measurement, but we don't keep track of what the outcome is, or it's inaccessible for some practical reason, then the state rho, the initial state rho, is updated to a state rho prime, which is a sum over the projectors of the possible outcomes weighted by the probability assignment of each outcome. That's the Born rule, the probability assignment. And that's how we describe the state after measurement. So we've gone from, suppose if the initial state rho is pure, then we evolve from a pure to a mixed state. Now that can be contrasted with another case, where we actually keep track of the measurement record, the measurement outcome, and then we want to describe the state in light of that new information, and not just in light of the fact that that information has been extracted. And then consistency with subsequent measurements demands the following transformation, which is that rho was the rho prime, which is a projector onto the eigenstate. Now, if the initial state was pure, it remains pure, but changes discontinuously to this projector. If the initial state was mixed, then it evolves from mixed to pure. Now, can we think of either of these transformations as being a unitary operation, either on the system alone or on the system plus some ancillary degrees of freedom? This question was asked last week. Well, what I'm going to show you is that while the first transformation can be modeled by a unitary acting on a system combined with some environmental degrees of freedom, the second transformation cannot. So it's really the second transformation that has to be modeled as has to be presumed to be an independent physical process in the orthodox view. Or really on any view, it has to be considered an independent process that's consistent with using quantum mechanics. So maybe, does that ring any bells about
Well, we looked at the heat map, but I'm pretty sure the situation we set up was first, was it like our particle is our own system and an environment particle, so it was two particles colliding with each other, but one was the environment and one was our particle, and I was pretty, there's other people in the class, I don't know whether Andy
or
explain it.
We said, you had a system of two atoms, and they come and interact with each other. And the first way we looked at it was said, well, let's say one atom is in the environment and one atom is our system. Then when they're here interacting, we collapse this atom. The atom quantum state collapses, it takes place. But instead, let's say that both atoms are our system. Then at that moment, when it wouldn't collapse, otherwise, it doesn't collapse. It only collapses later when we measure it. But it still collapses.
Yeah. Last time I brought up how Lindemann was careful to specify that when you apply the collapse rule, it's to some extent arbitrary. To what level you apply it? If you apply it just directly to the system, or if you couple the system to the measuring apparatus and then apply it to both, that you can do that in a consistent way and get the same answer. But it's still you still have to invoke the projection postulate to be a transformation of the second kind here. So actually, I go through this in more detail, so let's just maybe move on. Yeah.
Well, perhaps better after. My question is for the first operation, where it's extended to a mixed state, is it possible that we could have a set of unitary operations so that we, or even one unitary operation, we apply a row to get that, and then we apply again to row prime, and so on and so forth, such that as the process continues, some of those states become negligibly small in terms of their probabilities, so that over a long enough evolution, one state will become effectively 100%, and the rest will just arbitrarily decline into, you know, it's not likely to observe this within lifespan of the universe.
Okay, unitaries like that do exist, but what we're going to show now is that if you assume the unitary is modeling a faithful measurement, then it can't have that property. So I'll explain what I mean by that. So let me just say first that conceptually, look at the conception. It's clear that unitary evolution evolves any given state to some fixed final state. That's what a unitary does. So in this sense, it's a deterministic process in the sense of reproducible. If I give you some initial state, give you a unitary, and you apply it, mathematically what you find is that you always get the same state. And there's no ambiguity there. But in contrast, collapse is fundamentally stochastic. So if I give you some initial state and do a measurement, then sometimes you get a particular one state, k, and other times you get another state, k prime. So there's a randomness, which is fundamentally different from unitary evolution. But now we can ask, well, maybe this randomness comes from the unitary acting on a system plus some larger system. And the randomness I see in the outcome for the system alone is a result of different states of the environment. So it's some additional quantum degrees of freedom which are driving the different outcomes you obtain for the system alone. So that's the question. We describe the whole process by a unitary. So we'll consider this model system of an atom described by a pure state, which is in a coherent superposition of having two different trajectories. And we arrange again, like last week, so the trajectories pass through the detector, which is connected to a macroscopic point position, which moves to the left if the atom is on the up trajectory, and to the right if the atom is on the down trajectory. Now we want to try to model the measurement process with a unitary transformation. And so for complete generality, let's extend the quantum state to include some additional degrees of freedom, which are unspecified except we assign them a quantum state, from the label chi. Now we want this to represent a faithful measurement process. What that means is that if I know the system, the atom, is only on the up trajectory, so it's not in a superposition, it's just on up. And ready means the pointer is in the middle position, it's not right or left yet. Then the unitary has to take the up trajectory and multiply that full state so that the pointer goes to the left. And now we allow the state chi to be modified, just for generality. But now it also has to have the property that if we start in the down state, then the unitary evolution, whatever that unitary is, has to take the down state times the ready state times this chi state for any state chi, and has to drive that state to down times right times some new chi, no prime, which will allow it to be arbitrary. So this has to be true for any chi. If it wasn't true for some chi, that means I could prepare environmental states where you would get the wrong answer when you knew the answer was right. So you knew the particle was on the up or down trajectory. This isn't a coherence of position, this is just a single eigenstate. And yet you get the wrong answer. But now we're going to assume that the measure process is faithful, and then if we assume that, then we demand these two conditions. Now suppose we prepare a coherence of position over the two atomic trajectories, which allows for both of the possible outcomes upon measurement, as we know. Then by linearity, we deduce that we start with you, we have substitution alpha up plus beta down times the ready state times this chi state. But by linearity, we know that it has to go to alpha up times left times chi prime plus beta down times right times chi double prime. So this is just a linearity, of the unitary evolution as demanded by the first stipulations of faithful measurement. So we see that no matter what the unitary is, we're left in a coherent superposition as expected. We've made no restrictions other than the faithful measurement restriction. Yeah?
Why do we have to force chi to be the same for both states in the superposition? Because wouldn't preparing a superposition also possibly affect our extra coherent supremum? So possibly chi could be different for the two different states.
Yes, you could do that, but it wouldn't affect the answer, because if you just take a different chi associated with the upstate, then by linearity, that chi is driven to some chi triple prime, and the chi in the downstate is driven to some chi quadruple prime. And so we're still left with this coherent superposition by the linearity, and the fact that for all states, we have to have that faithful measurement.
But because it's not in, we would still get the faithful measurement. It's just that when we drop down to the superposition of states, we also have a superposition of the extra degrees of freedom.
The extra degrees of freedom would be in a superposition, and you're maintaining a superposition with these two. But notice you're still left with the superposition, whereas the measurement process, the transformation two, which I, as I called it, demands that the final state be either up or down, not a coherent superposition of both. So what I'm trying to show here is that
then because you have more degrees of freedom, like you would have, say, up left chi prime, up left chi triple prime, and so things could end up canceling out. Like chi triple prime could be minus chi prime.
I'm not sure what you mean by canceling out, because you would just add another state here and here. So you drop that one, and you put the chi's there. So you could say chi up and chi down. Then you'd be left here with chi up and chi down in place of chi prime and chi double prime. So you'd have exactly the same form, except there'd be different labels. I think this is one of maybe many ways you can show that really this idea of collapsing the state for sequential measurements is an independent process from the unitary rule. But let me show you now how the first process, where you drive, say, a pure state to a mixed state, how that can be obtained by including these ancillary degrees of freedom. So based on the form we got at the end there, if we want to ignore the ancillary degrees of freedom and just describe the system and the apparatus, then we have to take a partial trace over the degrees of freedom represented by the state space chi. And this partial trace produces the following reduced state after measurement, which is weighted alpha squared times the up state. The system endpoint, but this is just the system. So you get alpha squared up. That's here we trace over the measurement apparatus. It's a matter of labeling. We can also trace over the system. What I've done here is I've just ignored the measurement apparatus, just coupled the system to an environment, which is represented by chi, which you can think of as the measurement apparatus, or you can think of as some other degrees of freedom. The point being, when you trace over the system, you get the off-diagonal terms, represented by the up-down combinations, modified by the inner product of the two different states in each leg of the entangled superposition. Now, if these ancillary states are orthogonal, as they would be if they were, say, pointer position states, then we recover the transformation one, which is that we're left in a mixture of up and down weighted by the Borel probabilities fusion of those states. So we see that the projection transformation one, where we ignore post-selection, so here we've ignored the outcome obtained by the measurement, or just modeled the whole process, like interacting the system with some other system, then what we do is the system pure state evolves into a mixture of the two possibilities. And so this is an important process. It's called decoherence. And it shows us the non-classical features of the coherence superposition, such as interference effects, are eliminated because the system or apparatus is allowed to interact with ancillary degrees of freedom, which are either ignored or unknown, provided the states are orthogonal. Now, a common view in kind of contemporary approaches to understanding these processes is to assume that something like an apparatus is fundamentally interacting with some microscopic degrees of freedom, like dust particles or the cosmic microwave background. And that when we have a macroscopic apparatuses, or apparati, which is the correct one, really are always connected to these other degrees of freedom, and it's impossible to isolate them. And so as a result, as a practical result, one always has this kind of monitoring by system environment states. And that under very broad and general conditions, these environment states are driven to orthogonal states by reflecting off of the apparatus, interacting with it in whatever way. And so it's generically one expects for macroscopic systems that it's very difficult to maintain coherence between two different, say, pointer positions. That these are driven to an incoherent mixture on a very short time scale by these effects. But how does this help us from the point of view of interpretation? So does decoherence solve the measurement problem? So I guess it's difficult to here what we want to do is look at different possible ways in which one might claim that it solves the measurement problem and see what the problems are with those approaches. I'm kind of going through this in detail because it is a fairly kind of common view. It's what Bloom calls the new orthodoxy, is to represent decoherence in this life. So let's ask the question, when we interpret the final mixed state as an ordinary classical mixture of the two possible pointer positions. So the first problem with this approach is the ambiguity of mixtures that we discussed last week. That is, while we can write a state as being an incoherent sum of two different pointer states, there's an infinite number, it's not unique, and there's an infinite number of different decompositions that we can write that we can use to express a mixed state as an incoherent mixture of two other vectors in the state space, which have nothing to do with the pointer position. They can be some very non-classical states. So figuring out ways to, this is called the preferred basis problem, figuring out ways to specify if the mixture is in the basis that you want it to be in, namely the pointer positions. A second problem from an interpretational point of view is that the total system, whatever the collection of systems you've allowed to interact are, can still be described by a pure state, this entangled superposition of three different systems. So the fourth, now this is all solved in the orthodox view. So I'm assuming we take the orthodox postulates and see how we can make use of them by taking this extra ingredient of decoherence. So because the state is still in this total system state is still in this coherent superposition, the orthodox postulates do not allow us to assign definite positions to the combined system. So one has to ask, is it really self-consistent to say that, well, for the system alone, the atom alone, or the pointer or the pointer of the apparatus alone, I can say one's in a well-defined classical mixture of two different positions. But when I think about the system and the apparatus and the environment all combined as a total, then I'm not allowed to ascribe a definite position to any of them. So there's kind of a self-consistency issue there that is the satisfying. So, is there any way we can conclude that there is no longer a conflict between the orthodox interpretation and the existence of definite positions for the macroscopic pointer without the collapse postulate? Let's say? Yeah?
I was wondering, a lot of people doing cosmology, you know, are looking at like conflict causal histories, right? I mean, sort of, I'm just wondering what their take would be on this. The fact that you have that no information is available from the total system, it's a pure state, which has no entropy. There's no information available. So then, if you take a whole universe, and you want to talk about an evolution of the universe, and you just want to talk about history, or you want to talk about causality, etc. I mean, is there a problem here with the fact that there's no, I mean, there's no total information? I mean, is there a problem if you want to have a history, if you want to have a history that contains information, but you know that on the whole, it's pure?
Well, yeah, I think it's a big problem. Well, I mean, I think it's this kind of problem that people in history is trying to address, to try and apply the interpretation that works on a cosmological scale where there are no observers that can be used to invoke interaction with some observing system. So what, you know, the idea is trying to come up with a consistent way to make assignments about properties for a system for which there's no external system that can be acting as an observer. But you'll have the chance to ask that question to some of the lecturers who are coming this semester who are concerned directly with that problem.
Okay. Do you think maybe there's two notions of time right now? I mean, the unitary notion of time and then one that does produce information. But inside the system, you have information, and there is a sense of history that is has information that is extractable and can radiate out to the rest of the system. But then there's also a sense of unitary time transformation as well.
No, I don't think states are real, so I don't have any issues with the question posture. So I've got someone who does think states are real, how do we deal with that issue? For me, the collapse postulate is nothing more or less than what you see in legal mechanics. It doesn't change any of our conventional notions of time being a parameter that flows. It just represents a change in information. So, just emphasizing the point I've already made, that the eigenvalue eigenstate link tells us that definite properties of positions can only be assigned if the combined state is in some factor or form, with the atom being in the up path and the average, for example, pointing to the left. And so a mixed state obtained by partial tracing over the environment, or one of these two systems even, is not in that form, and therefore, on the orthodox view, cannot be assigned a definite property. But yet we know that macroscopic pointer positions do have definite properties. So there in a nutshell, is the problem of interpretation from the orthodox view. And let me just emphasize that the orthodox view has a way out for this problem, which is the projection postulate. So it posits the projection postulate as a separate physical transformation that occurs upon measurement, but it does not specify under what conditions that process takes place, and what causes that process to occur. So that's the problem with the orthodox view. And let me just give you a quick synopsis of different approaches to getting around these problems with contemporary interpretations. So this is just kind of a few kind of off-the-cuff remarks about what you can expect over the next 3 months or 2 months of lectures. So to get some kind of consistent description of macroscopic facts requires either expanding upon or rejecting some of the interpretive postulates of the orthodox interpretation. So what do I mean by expanding upon? Well, here we have as an example dynamical collapse models, which actually specify the exact condition under which collapse occurs as a dynamical process. But typically this is done by adding a non-linear term to the Schrodinger equation. Now all of a sudden our transformations are no longer linear, and this allows a broader range of phenomena, including a collapse process. Now, strictly speaking, these aren't interpretations as we define them. We talked about interpretations as taking the mathematical formalism and coming up with a set of rules which relate elements of the mathematical formalism, elements of physical reality. What dynamic and class models typically do is modify the mathematical formalism, like through the nonlinear Schrodinger equation. And that allows them to circumvent the difficulties associated with the unspecified and observer-induced projection postulate that's given by the binomial duality. So we'll have Philip Pearl discussing this in March, now another approach is the many worlds interpretation, developed by Everett way back to 57, which rejects the projection postulate and imagines reality dividing into alternate, equally valid branches. So I'm not an expert on this, so I won't go into the detail, but just suffice to say that next week you get someone presenting that view to you. And then given the digression into decoherence, I should mention and emphasize that in many contemporary interpretations, decoherence is a critical ingredient to getting the right kind of ontology. And so one example is the existential interpretation advocated by Wojciech Zurek, which he acknowledges as a variation of the many worlds interpretation. And another example is the decoherent consistent histories formalism, which was introduced as consistent histories by Griffiths and extended by Gell-Mann and Hartle to include decoherence. And this was described to us by Griffiths in the second week of March. I have a direct quote from him where he says that this shares many similarities with the Everettian relative state interpretation.
Every time I told him he was a winning world, he thought that he was horrifying.
All right, well, he acknowledged the similarities with it, and that's the only way I can understand it. So. And then let me just mention that. Last but certainly not least, we have interpretations which reject the assumption of completeness. And so by rejecting the assumption of completeness, the projection postulate is no longer a physical process, not necessarily a physical process. So on the one hand, there is the kind of modest statistical interpretation. It's developed by Bob Valentine. He acknowledges basically following Einstein's views, where Einstein is well known to have rejected the completeness assumption. And this view emphasizes that there's a statistical or epistemic nature to the one state rather than ontological nature. So we have Leslie Valentine will come in February and describe statistical interpretation, and then myself and Rob Speckens will kind of add further fuel to the flames of why the state has to be understood epistemically later in March. So on the other hand, there are interpretations which reject the completeness assumption but go a lot further. And these are interpretations which explicitly identify the hidden variables that are needed to completely specify the system's ontic state. So the most celebrated one is the de Broglie-Bohm interpretation, or pilot wave theory, which was developed by de Broglie for one-dimensional systems in 1927, and developed the more or less complete theory by Bohm in 1952. And so we have two lecturers, Shelley Goldstein in February, introducing us to this, and further elaboration by Anthony Valentini in March. So on Thursday, we'll spend our last introductory lecture discussing some of the constraints on hidden variables. So I wanted to start doing that today, but didn't have a chance to prepare the notes. Basically, we'll go through first Einstein's reason for rejecting the completeness assumption of the orthodox view based on a non-locality argument. And then later, we'll go on and study the constraints on hidden variables that were discovered mainly by Bell. And these particular are the properties of non-locality and contextuality. So we'll go through that on Thursday. So I guess with that, I'll end today's lecture, and we'll turn to discuss the term projects now. But before that, Is there any issues anyone wants to bring up for discussion? Yeah.
Both of you showed that the user transformation cannot lead to a collapse of your imagined state. I don't quite understand. It seems to me you're saying that it has to be a superposition, but it seems to me it seems to me that it's possible that one of the optimum betas would be equal to zero.
Well, I'm assuming that alpha and beta, if alpha or beta is equal to zero, then we don't have a problem. But one thing for allowed states, alpha and beta are both non-zero. So, you'd be flatly denying the existence of a huge number of states which are experimentally verified in the lab today. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I misunderstand your question.
Well, I guess what I'm saying is that we don't know what you only know about you is that it has to be a user transformation. And I don't see why, in that argument, I don't see why that user transformation would not be a state of the sense that all one of the constants after the data is equal to zero.
It can do that, but it cannot do that for arbitrary alpha and beta and at the same time satisfy the faithful measurement assumptions that I remember what those were. In fact, if the system is in an eigenstate corresponding to the up trajectory, then the pointer has to be driven to the pointer position being on the left. And if the system is in a down trajectory, then the pointer has to be driven to a position on the right. So if the unitary has those properties, then you cannot also have the property of driving alpha up plus beta down to either just up or down. That would not be a unitary transformation then. Yeah.
Why then do we accept the faithful measurement postulate? Is it really required?
Well, it's part of the assumption that we can actually measure properties. The notion that if I'm measuring whether the atom is up or down, that I am indeed measuring whether it's up or down, and that I'm doing so in a faithful way.
Is that in fact the case, though?
Well,
there's lots of crazy stuff.
In the lab, you're never sure.
Well, in the world.
In the lab, you will get false positives, or you will get the wrong answers sometimes. And then probably the analysis is much more complicated, and you get into loopholes in the detection of Bell's inequalities, for example, where you assume that, it's a conspiracy such as that. In practice in the lab, yeah, you're right. You'll have cases where you create the system in the upstate and you don't get the pointer going to the left. And then, it is possible probably to construct theories where you take the precision with which you have faithful measurements, so it's sort of only 99% of the time it works, and 1% of the time it doesn't. And I don't know if you can still.
That's a truer representation of reality anyways, but not possible.
But I doubt that with any finite, it's a good question, and it's not clear. My guess is that even with some finite error, you still would not be able to represent the process as unitary.
But I think the point that they bring is that if you can think about it that way, and this is the usual way that you think about this, but maybe there's a different way where you can just have to be idealistic.
Yeah. And I would assume that too, but working through it, you might find it's not actually the case.
Yeah.
Yeah, we don't want to end up in a situation where systems are not realistic. You can't really then talk about physics. You can't measure the world. The world doesn't interact in any sort of regular way at all.
Well, that's a regular way, just not a perfectly regular way. Because there are positive rays and unexpected things popping up.
But you can, in principle, take account of all that.
No, in principle, but that principle doesn't apply to the world we live in at all. It's just not a principle that I, as a physicist, maybe a mathematician might.
Well, maybe you guys can have a discussion later. Are there any other questions that, yeah?
When we say that people reject their completeness, does that mean that they're rejecting mathematical completeness? Is that mean?
No. Okay. Yeah, it's completeness of the interpretive rules, not completeness of the formalism. Well, yeah.
So, okay, I have some questions along the same line. So, when you're saying completeness, are we just saying something is going on, but we don't really know? So, so the projection process seems sort of identical. I thought we were measuring.
Well, it's not really ad hoc. I mean, a lot of the I've read is on interpretations emphasize or pretend that the projection postulate is brought out specifically to deal with the measurement problem as an ad hoc solution. But from what I've read, that's not the case at all. It's brought out for very operational reasons, and yes, it does kind of get around the measurement problems as well. But it's motivated by operationalism, like when I'm looking at a Kolchak experiment, where you have two particles and you measure particle one, and that allows you to predict the momentum of the other, and then you need the projection postulate to do that. Well, the projection postulate is a consistent way to do that. But I think what's ad hoc is the completeness assumption. I mean, there, you know, you don't really have anything but, you know, religious prejudice for assuming that this thing is a complete description, and Bohm showed that explicitly. So, and the problems with the projection problem will arise because of the completeness assumption. Then you assume that it's a statistical process rather than some kind of information update, which we do every day. Yeah, John?
You talked about how the projection postulate could be regarded as a sort of objective change in the physical properties of the system. And indeed, you noted that if we accept the eigenstate eigenvalue, then we have to put that position. Then you noted another position, which is that it just somehow represents a change in our knowledge, so we change our description of the system. Well, actually, I think you said that you subscribe to this yourself and that it's pretty much analogous to updating our probabilities and algorithm values. But there is a third possibility, which is that it's both.
Yeah.
It could be that the system has changed and also our knowledge has changed, and we're combining these things on new description, which would be an statement.
Yeah, I do.
What I want to argue is that that last possibility is actually consistent, but I don't think it's consistent to say that it's exactly analogous to what happens in algorithm games.
No.
For example, if I prepare a spin half system and spin up in the Z dimension, then I know that if I measure spin Z, I'll get spin up. Now if I measure spin X, I'm guessing the other half of them. Well, that's my statement. It might be that if I damage spin Z, I'm not going to spin up. So some things will change.
Well, I mean, you can imagine that if you have your spin half particle, and if the state up represents the system being somewhere in the upper hemisphere, but you don't know where, and the state on the right or left being measuring, so this is Z, this is X. So if you measure up, it means you're just checking, is the vector somewhere in this upper hemisphere? And then if you measure X, you're checking if it's somewhere in the hemisphere on the right. And I guess you have to introduce some kind of fundamental disturbance relation so that subsequently, if you get a yes to up along Z and a yes to up along X, that we allowed to get no, the yeses to down along Z in subsequent measures.
After
you've done the X. And so,
yes, I mean, this is what I'm saying. So you have to step it's up.
Yeah.
Now we're looking at it, just after we've done both, we know that it exists.
Yeah, I meant conceptually analogous. But it's clear that, as you know, Rob showed with his toy model, that if you include a classical disturbance as an intrinsic property of the measurement, then you can reproduce these sequential measurements and get Z up on one try, get X up and then get Z down. But there's nothing kind of mysterious about that. It's just a disturbance in the form of classical update. Yeah.
Okay, but isn't the collapse partially always going to be a physical phenomenon? And because to collapse the system, you have to take a measurement of the system. There's going to be a physical process involved.
Right, there's a physical process involved doing anything, whether it's measuring or whatever. But the question is whether or not when you change the state from being psi prime. Is that transformation of the state physical? Is there a physical transformation of the system's properties? In other words, to repeat the kind of Liouville example from last week, if I know the particle, this is my momentum from my position, and then I don't know where the particle is in my phase space, but I have some probability density, which describes the possibilities. And then I do a measurement which tests whether the particle is to the right or to the left of this line along Q0. Then, if I get an answer yes, that it's on the right, then I have to change my state to being just this state, which is the overlap between the two allowed regions. And then I change my state from this state to this state. Now that's not a transformation of the physical properties of the system. See, the whole time the system was right here and never got changed or disturbed at all.
But in order to take a measurement of this particle, you're going to have to disturb resistance elements.
Oh, you mean following what John wrote. Yeah, that's a good point. So that if you do have this disturbance relation and you want to reproduce quantum mechanical type effects, then the measures would always have some physical process, which would be at least some physical disturbance if the system were. So yeah, do that one, that's a good point. Yeah.
I'm curious, like, I was thinking about that if you had, like, two qubits, for example, and you had a unitary between them, they just continuously running. So, each, or, like, you have two quantum systems in there, there's a tangling operator that's continuously happening. So, each subsystem is going through these, like, phases, right? Let's say that you had access to one, but not access to the other. So, someone else controls. You just don't have access to it. You don't have access to the unitary, you don't have access to the system. So from your perspective, right, you have a changing probability distribution. You have to trace up that system. And it's continuously evolving, right, this probability distribution. Perhaps you could say, like, you start in a unitary evolution at some point, and you do the definite state of both systems, but then the other one goes very far away.
Is leading up to a question, I'm not sure.
Well, how do you see the evolution of the subsystems? How do you see the evolution of these subsystems? Because they're not pure, right? So in the whole case, they're pure. But in some cases, they're not. So they're exhibiting their property that they have information for you, right? If the whole system doesn't have information for you, but the subsystem has, miraculously does. But it's evolving.
Can you ask a question?
I'm just saying, like, how do you see the evolution of this system? I mean, normally you think of a whole Hilbert space together and it's evolving around. But in the other case, you have that sort of, it's gone now from a, it's a continuously evolving probability distribution, but it's also different type of system altogether, right?
I'm not sure what you're getting at. What's a different type of system?
Well, one has entropy, right? And it's...
Well, they both have entropy. They change values for the entropy at the same time.
That's right.
Well, one has zero entropy if it's a pure state, and the other one will have some finite entropy if it's the systems are entangled.
So that's what I'm asking. If you were to look, I mean, supposedly I'm asking, if you were to see this thing sitting in space-time, or if you're supposed to see this thing evolve, what would be the difference between the evolving thing, so the evolving probability distribution, as opposed to the evolving pure state? I mean, do you see it as a real thing? If you see the Hilbert space as a real thing, right? Like, you kind of imagine.
No, I don't see the Hilbert space as a real thing. So, maybe that's where we diverge. Maybe that's like an understanding question. It's an abstract mathematical formula, so there's no reason to assign it any reality at all. In life. But I'm sure you'll find some of the lecturers this semester being very sympathetic to the view of quantum space. It's something new. Because it's, I think the basic psychological point is that we have a fundamental theory, and so we assume that because it's fundamental, it must be real. Yeah.
I have a more experimental type of question.
Sure.
To go back to the spin-up, spin-down particle, can you actually make subsequent measurements?
Yes.
Same look, it's turned your line.
Yeah.
Or you just go ahead and turn your line back.
Yeah, but then you're not looking at superposition because you're not predicting where the fact that particle passed after the first term of the rack. They're just depending at the end, so that's one measurement. It's not reaching its superposition.
You can measure that the charge has passed. Okay, charge particle.
Okay.
Then you measure this again as one, so.
That's true.
Okay.
All right, well, okay, we're trying to do those questions. So I think now we'll turn to the discussion of the term project. So Ray has some points to bring up. Basically, the idea is for the term projects, one approach is to compare and contrast two of the interpretations that we'll go over through the course. So that'll be, you would compare and contrast two of the set many worlds, system histories, statistical interpretation, the rolling bone, and spontaneous collapse models. Another approach is to review and critically evaluate one of the fundamental papers on foundations and interpretation. So Ray will suggest some more of the information, give you some more of the information with that. And also the web. So your assignment is almost ready. It'll be available on the website probably by Thursday. I'll probably announce it on Thursday.
Okay, we set up a website for the course. It's made with all QIP course, and if you go there and you'll see two parts, intervention one and then there. And then we'll end up on the right website. On there you'll find the synopsis for the course and the schedule and stuff about projects and stuff about assignments. So, do you get a name for when we visit? So, first assignment will be due February 1st, and we should have it on the website by Thursday, so we'll have 2 weeks to do it. Now, to go back to the project, Joseph has mentioned the basic idea, and there'll be a section there on the website about details of the project. The goal of the project is to show that you can think about the issues of interpretation of quantum mechanics. So how do you show that you can think about these issues? Then the undergrad will write an essay of 10 to 15 pages, and the grad about 20 to 25 pages. And in there, I don't want somebody who just starts to burn for 25 pages, who wants to see an introduction, what is the question you're asking, why are you asking it, and what is part of the answer, all of the introduction, what are the points. Green development of the idea, and conclusion. I had some essays last term on the introduction of quantum computing course, and I couldn't understand why people did not add an introduction to some of their essays. So here, be sure that it is readable. And it should not be readable only by Joseph at me, but between peers on that course, it should be readable and understandable.
Yeah, so at the end of the introduction, you have a brief synopsis or outline of the points, the main points in the argument of the paper.
So the goal, repeat it again, show that you can do some critical thinking. Or maybe I should rephrase it slightly. Convince us that we can do critical thinking. Okay? Should be electronic papers in PDF. LaTeX preferred. Is there anybody who doesn't know LaTeX?
File what?
What?
What file?
word?
Yeah, word file. So the you know, what are the functions you're competing for the diffusion? And also can we transfer it to the latency?
Well, there's three equations. It's all going to have equations, these things. So as long as we can do equations and we're...
Yeah, they can do. What I want to have is hyperref. I've passed from the paper lights to an electronic light, so I don't print anything. So the harder you do it for me to read your essays, like the harder it is, the harder you get to get into this course. So I have to click in to see what are the references, you push on, and with PDF and LaTeX you can do this with the hyperref. Then it is great. Ask your peers if you don't know about hyperref or anything. But you can do it with Windows, it's fine with me. Just make my life easy, and then I'm a lot more positive when I write ID 25 of these essays. Due date.
What's a hyperref?
Is it just a reference that is
a
hyperlink?
Yeah, with a link. So it links to the end of your paper where your reference are.
Oh,
so you don't have to kind of click to go to the end of your paper, and then when you arrive there, then you have to click and remember, oh, I was at page 7. So you just click.
Okay.
It's encoding as well.
Yeah, no, I know what you're talking about.
Okay. If you use that compact, yeah, read your PDF file, you have all things to know what we have to read.
Cool.
Due date. I was thinking the 1st of April. I like that day.
Yeah.
Many years ago, I submitted my PhD thesis on the 1st of April. And none of my feelings on the show.
The 4th is a Tuesday. 4th of April is December 5th. So that would be Saturday.
Yeah.
It's electronically.
It should be submitted electronically. And the address. And it will be on the website. It's QIP course, and without an E. This is one of the great Unix things that 8 letters is enough to get to at iqc.ca. And it is midnight. So now I should talk about the subject of these essays. So one possibility is take two interpretations discussed in the course. And analyze them, and then contrast them, and tell what are the positive and the cons of both of them. Second, take one interpretation, not mention the course, and by when I say not mention, I really mean that the invited lecturers are going to come and talk about different interpretations like consistent history or many worlds or those
not covered
in the course.
Yeah,
that's it. Take one of them and analyze them. So ideas on there is. You mentioned a little bit the coherence today, but nobody's going to talk about it. There's something called the model interpretation and macro-realism. And on the website, I'll give reference. We'll give reference for those three. And if you think about other ones, also that I've mentioned here, you can go and take one of them. There's a very good reference for this, this one.
Do you know the reference? Model interpretation, I give the book called Blue.
Okay, I'll put it on the website. This one by Zurek
review of modern physics, volume 75, page 77, roughly, 2003. This one is boom. And it's called Interpreting the Quantum World. Published in the last 5 years, I can put the actual reference online. I'll give you those references. I have to double check that one. Yeah, I guess. So, for this take one interpretation, it's review and critically assess it. Don't be required. And reviewing a historical paper.
Is this your third option or just?
Third option. And there is a book by John Archibald Wheeler and Wojciech Herbert Zurek called Quantum Theory of Measurement. There's a copy at PI Library. There's another one at UW, but it's out, but I'm trying to bring it back, and I also have a copy if you want to. There's a series of very interesting historical papers, I guess, like a Schrödinger cat paper is in there translated in many ways.
It's just a collection of reprints of all the important papers, from EPR paper to all those papers, and Schrödinger's cat paper, all that.
In fact, it's fun just to browse. It's a really interesting question. Okay, so you would take one paper, and there are papers in there who are 2 pages long. If you take this, which you can, you be sure that you expand this 2-page paper into something which is readable in 10 to 15 pages. And we don't want, again, just for you to go to the paper and say, this equation here can be used right by this. Critical assessment.
When you also, if you really want a top grade on this, you have to contextualize that paper with the relevant papers it's either addressing or papers subsequent to it that critically analyzed it. So you should have, I think on the face of it, this one's going to be easier than the other two because it's just reviewing the paper. So more will be expected in terms of your analysis of the paper by comparing it to other papers that are relevant and so on.
Okay, I'll give an example of something you would expect. Suppose that you would take the paper by Schrödinger on the cat paradox. I would expect you to go and look in the recent years at an experiment on Schrödinger's cat, making them from the laboratory, looking at them. So I would expect you to go in that direction and analyze one or two experiments, or at least see that you've gone beyond just reading that paper and stating what the problem is. And the final option, so this was 3, 4, is that you have the possibility of putting your own suggestion. An example of here that I could think about is that some experimental realization. Related to foundation of quantum mechanics. Then that would be something like, we'll mention EPR experiments, there's been a set of experiments. You could go and look at them, and they all have good things about them and bad things about them, so this is the kind of thing we'd like you to think about. Any questions?
Yep.
When you say the page numbers, the number of pages, is that single or double spaced?
Single.
Hard.
Oh, hard. Okay. You give these 15 pages double space, then it's okay. You can give me 10 page single space with a big break between the paragraph. Okay. You understand? I'm not going to go and count 9 pages and a half. But if you really put some effort, which is what I did work when you read these things, and a half.
Yeah.
I'm not going to be stupid on that, but it's an order of magnitude that we're on. If somebody does 10 pages, but he has lots of pictures which are not really helping, it's a very nice diagram between different things. This is great. I really encourage this. But if it's just about 10 pages and half enough pictures, then
I think that's stick his tongue out.
There's a guy who sticks his tongue out, who can make a point also. So, okay, any more questions?
It's probably get the last two questions on the website.
Lecture 1 and 2 is already on the website that I. On this website, lecture 3 is. Lecture 4, the last Thursday, not, but this should be relatively easy because.
Yeah,
we
haven't typed up.
It was already typed up.
Lecture 1 is going to have edited a bit still, so.
These notes are on.
And these were notes. Marcus Silva, one of the students, has taken notes and we're putting them here. Although he's not here today, so they will be a bit harder.
Those are those ones?
Yeah. There's also the video ones, and I'll put a link on the website when I can set it out so that it's a good question.
You want to say that Student Bus Night is going to be on the 24th, which is Monday, at 8 o'clock at Molly's Bloom. Professors are especially encouraged to attend. On Monday, at Molly's Bloom.
Because the Monday coming.
It is Monday coming, yes.
My part, that's going to make it. It's
better.
Yeah.
Three figures if you.
No, I can't take it off.
If I were you, I would just talk to you about three figures.
I also know that.
Okay.
I'm going to go to the next one.